Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 15th, 2006. Our session today is titled Scouring Hell with a Restless Reconciler. Our presenter is Fred Niedner. Session number NIF 2006-4. Let's listen in.
Been giving one another a shoulder rub, but as I looked around this morning and saw all that rhubarb strudel in your hands, I had visions of some very messy shirts, necks, and floor, and that doesn't even count what might happen to the coffee. So if you choose to give one another a shoulder rub, perhaps we can do that at the end, after you have licked your fingers clean. Well, on Tuesday, I began with answers. Today, I have some questions. These are much in circulation these days, and surely some of you have heard some or all of these. Where do forest rangers go to get away from it all? It's a good Holden question. How much deeper would the oceans be if sponges didn't live there? And what exactly was the greatest thing before sliced bread? And finally, here's a theological question that perplexes me, it may not you. If there is no God, then just who makes the next Kleenex pop up in the box? Matthew's gospel, from which we take our theme verse, has a reasonably obvious way to answer the question we've been asking. Where is this risen Christ of yours, and what is he doing now? Or to put it more bluntly, what has he done for us lately? That great commission text at the end of Matthew suggests, as we've said, that whenever people respond and wherever people respond to Jesus sending to go out, baptizing and teaching, the risen one goes with them. If you look around the rest of Matthew, you find that this fits closely with Jesus' promise back in Matthew 18, where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among them. And here Jesus, or perhaps Matthew, borrows an old rabbinic statement centuries older than the Gospel of Matthew. Wherever two or three are gathered together studying Torah, the Holy One resides in their midst. The theme of abiding presence comes also at the beginning of Matthew's story. Jesus' birth fulfills an old promise of Isaiah, the one about the birth of the Emmanuel child back there in the 7th century. Never mind all the young woman versus virgin controversies surrounding the teaching of that piece of Matthew. The real point of the Isaiah text and also of Matthew's birth story, use of that text, has to do not with virginity, but with fear. With this child in our midst, we have nothing to fear. And yet, we disciples of every age, before and after Matthew, actually have trafficked in fear. For much of my life, I'll admit that if someone had asked me the question, why are you a Christian? Not meaning how did you get to be a Christian, but why do you stay a Christian? What is the point of being a Christian? I'm sure that I would have said that the whole idea was somehow or another to be saved, or better perhaps, to be spared. Or put more crassly, I wanted to have my ticket punched for the preferable afterlife. I thought early on in my days as a Christian that it was mostly about going to heaven after death, and more importantly, not ending up in hell. And no gospel fed that belief more than Matthew, what with his dozen or so times in parables and other teachings that end up with folks who fail some test or another being cut asunder or cast into outer darkness or tossed into a furnace of fire, and always where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. Matthew brings to mind an old yellowed Peanuts cartoon strip I have in my files back home. In it, Lucy informs Charlie Brown, "I could have become a great evangelist." "Why is that?" Charlie asks. "Well, you know that kid who sits behind me in school? I convinced him that my religion is better than his religion," Lucy explained. Charlie asks, "How'd you do that?" Lucy says, "Hit him with my lunchbox." Perhaps Matthew sought to scare people into following Christ and ancient Jonathan Edwards. But at this point in my life, I have a very different sense of the purpose in Jesus' call to discipleship, and I choose a different way to read Matthew. It seems to me, for now at least, that the point of following Jesus has to do less with escaping hell than doggedly finding one's way to hell. Indeed, let me remind you that in Matthew's gospel, Jesus once told his faithful sidekick, Rocky Johnson, also known as Simon Bar-Jona, "Go to hell, my friend, straight to hell. Indeed, they can't keep you out." Do you remember the scene? I have paraphrased it. Matthew 16. The scene is Caesarea Philippi. Jesus has asked his famous question, "Who do people say that I am? And then who do you say that I am?" And after Peter makes his confession, Jesus says, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. I'll give you the keys to the realm of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Well, for decades, I saw myself as part of a community that hid in a safe place, and the powers of hell could beat like hell upon our doors like the big bad wolf, but they could not beat their way in. Our house was made of bricks, strong bricks, mostly made of doctrines and dogma, and hell could not assail us. But one of my teachers finally pointed out one day in class the way that text in Matthew really works. The image is precisely the reverse of what I'd believed all my life. In Jesus' charge to Peter, it's hell that cowers in fear, hiding inside gates and walls, and here comes Rocky Johnson with keys and whatever else it would take to blow that house down and free whoever's trapped there, and hell does not stand a chance of remaining hell. Those keys, of course, are part of Matthew's elaborate theology of forgiveness. "Jesus shall be the child's name," says the angel in chapter 1, "because he will save his people from their sins." And later on in chapter 12, Jesus boldly claims amidst a fight with some Pharisees that every sin and blasphemy of humankind can and will be forgiven period. Well, except for the sin against the Holy Spirit, whatever that is, which remains impervious to the powers of forgiveness, but that's a whole nother session, maybe next week. And then in chapter 18, Jesus explains how to go about the business of handling sin in a community such as this one or yours back home. First, he tells the parable of the shepherd who will not rest till every lost sheep is found and gathered in. Then he describes the famous procedure. If your brother or sister sins against you, go and point out the fault. First, talk one-on-one. If that fails, have two or three friends join you in trying to be heard, and finally, the whole congregation may have to gather. And how shall all this talking sound? What shall be the content of the conversation? Well, I can only tell you that fault-telling hasn't worked in my home. I have tried it more times than I can count, and I am very good at making it indirect but inescapable that everything is your fault. But some years ago, I tackled this expression in Matthew's original Greek only to find that there is no fault telling there, only a verb that means to speak as convincingly as you can. There is a way, I think, that we can use the language of fault and still be true to that shepherd whose main goal is having all the sheep back and who doesn't seem very interested, at least not in that parable, in exactly how that one wayward sheep got lost again. I think we must talk convincingly as we can about plate tectonics, about the fault lines that have developed among us and now divide us, lines that we simply cannot let grow any wider. I don't know how else to think about this work except to step off my own little continental shelf and into the abyss that's now between me and the one from whom I am divided. It will kill me, of course, even as it did Christ, to give up all my claims of being right and not the one at fault. God, do I love my rightness. I love being right more than I love anything else in the whole world, more than ice cream, more than food, more than water, more than wine, more even than sex. If you ever doubt that human beings love being right more than anything else in all the world, including that list I just cited, then just try getting married. Personally, it's the most efficient laboratory I know of for testing the hypothesis. Yes, there will be hell to pay if I'm to get back together with you, or you with me. But sometimes we just don't get it to work. So then what, Jesus? Well, treat that one like a tax collector or a Gentile, Jesus says. Which is how? Well, depends on who you ask, Jesus or the Pharisees. So the way I see it, if we use Jesus' model, which I would suggest is the one we ought to entertain, then we're going to be eating in hell's kitchen for a while, is how I usually put it. Welcome to the gnashing teeth diner. If others won't come in to sit with us and share bread and cup at our table, then we go out to theirs. That's Jesus' way, and now ours. There came a time, you recall, that Jesus lost two of his own. Peter denied that he even knew Jesus just to save his sorry hide. The early church dealt with such cases all the time. They called them the lapsed Christians. But they knew their first leader was one of them. And if Jesus could have taken such a one back and made so remarkable a witness out of him, well, then perhaps they could take them back as well. And then there was Judas, the traitor. Well, even he could have come back by the theology of forgiveness that we see in Matthew. Every sin and blasphemy can and will be forgiven, even speaking against the Son of Man, Jesus had said. And after all, Jesus had given Judas too the cup full of forgiving lifeblood back there at that Last Supper, and even in Gethsemane, after the kiss of betrayal, Jesus called Judas friend. But Judas didn't make it back for a talk with Jesus, or two or three, or the whole congregation. Judas gave up on forgiveness. Well, does the one he betrayed give up on this fault line as well? Does the God to whom Jesus himself cries out in abandonment give up on Judas? Well, we don't have the hour or so that it would take to thoroughly examine Matthew's paragraph that reports Judas' death, but I believe that the answer to our question is buried there, meant for us to find it. Suffice it to say here, that while Judas' own place of burial remains unknown, that blood money that he hurled back at the priests got used to buy a field that now has Jesus' blood, that blood of forgiveness, spilled all over it. A field used for burying strangers, foreigners, like those who happened to die in town at Passover, and there was no way to ship them home. Then Matthew does something peculiar at the end of that paragraph. He quotes from Zechariah, but he attributes the text to Jeremiah and says those words got fulfilled. An error? Not hardly, but a reason for all of us to remember how Jeremiah once bought a field from a cousin who tried to dupe him, because that field to which Jeremiah had family rights was full of all the Babylonian soldiers in the world. The enemy had occupied Tekoa and its surrounding. What do you suppose that field was worth? Jeremiah bought it because to him it was worth all the hope in the world. It's full of strangers and enemies now, he said, but one day, they will all be my people. God's people will live there. That's how far God's forgiveness extends. And we are the agents of that forgiveness. We work for the restless reconciler. We have no commission or charge that includes ever the possibility of giving up on a forgiveness project, even if we must go all the way to hell to get that work done. The work of taking the love of Christ to places where no love is known, where no forgiveness is yet possible. Are you, am I, afraid to go there? For sure. I cannot even look a traitor in the eye most of the time, much less offer the peace of Christ. But every time we baptize someone, at least, we promise that nothing ever will remove that one from our care or concern. We will not let anything, not even the gates of hell, separate us from that one. So if they end up there, we must go too. So can we go? Can we step into the abyss at that fault line, despite our fears? Well, one more time, our theme verse. Only this time with an additional word we've ignored so far. The NRSV reads, "Remember, I am with you always." The older translation said, "Lo," or "Behold, I am with you." The Greek there is actually a translation of an old and very important Hebrew formula that sounds like this, hineni. In fact, there's a book in the bookstore with this as its title. It's all about the Bible's moments of hineni. Behold, I. Behold, me. Or how we translate it in the Hebrew Bible is, here am I. This is exactly how those whom God summons, such as Abraham, when God had that crazy idea that the father should take his son to the mountaintop to offer himself up as a sacrifice. Or Isaiah, when God called him to give up a comfortable life for the guaranteed sorrow of a prophet's calling. Or in our own Christian book, when the angel came with that preposterous summons for Mary in Luke's first chapter. Each one of those said, hineni, here am I, send me. The one who would send us all the way to hell to do his bidding does not send us alone, but at the beginning of his summons says himself, here am I, send me. I'll go with you everywhere. We have many reasons to confess, as we do in our creed, that Mary's God with us child descended to hell, that place of profound absence of God, and by going there, unheld it. Sometimes our own hellbound journeys are dramatic. They are miraculous, even I believe, because you can't force forgiveness to happen nor demand that victims forgive. When it does happen, it's a miracle. And I have a collection of such stories, and I thought about reading some of those amazing ones to you, and surely you've heard some of them, like that somewhat famous story from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission proceedings in South Africa, in which an old woman many years later asks that the policeman who had cruelly murdered both her only child and her husband before her very eyes, that man become her son, so she might have someone to love. But ordinarily, our forays into the abyss are merely part of another day's work on the roadways of discipleship. I have an everyday story to share. For many years, my wife has gathered once a week, early in the morning, with three other women. They talk, they laugh, they cry, they love one another. Once a few years ago, somewhere between those weekly liturgies, harsh words passed suddenly and unexpectedly between two of those women. And all four of them inevitably and eventually knew of the matter. A fault line had appeared between them. A wall had sprung up. And only afterwards did I learn not only of the anxiety with which my wife had gone that next time to be with her friends, and surely all the rest of them as well, but also how that fault line had got bridged. Something very simple happened. One of the four, not a party to the screaming match, a woman named Kathy, came to the meeting that morning with a page she had copied from the Stanley Home Repair Book titled Removing a Partition, which she simply proceeded to read at the beginning of their time together as the agenda for the day. I have that page with me, and in the spirit of Holden Work Camp, maybe you could go over and at least smell the drywall in Koinonia and think about this. I offer this to you as a parable about forgiveness, everyday style. Those who have ears to hear, let them hear. Removing a partition. Taking out a non-bearing wall is a job that you can accomplish in a matter of hours. It calls for careful preparation, however, and in some cases you will need a building permit. Be prepared for hard work afterward when you have to pick up and dispose of the debris. Most municipal garbage haulers won't take it. And patch the walls and ceiling where the old wall was attached. Begin by satisfying yourself beyond any doubt that the wall you want to remove is not a structural part of your house. Finally, put on a long-sleeved shirt, a hard hat, goggles, a dust mask, heavy work gloves, and thick-soled shoes. Now you are ready to begin. But for us, one more thing. Sometimes hell is just a dusty place we've created all by ourselves and left untended far too long. No matter how ours looks, we assault that fortress with this promise. Here am I. I go with you always. Thank you. And we'll sing our little song again. Go in peace to serve the living Christ.
Thanks be to God.
And if you feel like giving back rubs with your clean fingers, feel free.